This is Audible.
Audible Studios presents Wanna Bet? A Degenerate Gambler's Guide to Living on the Edge. Written by Artie Lang. Performed by Oliver Wyman.
Introduction. Place your bets. When you think about it, and lately I have, everything we do comes down to risk. Where you end up in life is all about what you are willing to do to get there. And no one gets anywhere without gambling a bit. You can go on all you want about making your own destiny by visualizing your goals. You can read The Secret. You can listen to self-help tapes. I encourage those of you who believe in that bullshit to keep it up, because it leaves a lot of room at the front of the line for the people with brains who believe in logic. Those people know that what you do when your life comes to a crossroad is what determines who you are. Those moments are no time to be timid, because how much you bet can make all the difference in the path your life takes. This might sound very simplistic or black and white to some of you, but if you see it that way, you're missing the point. Risk is important, but it isn't the only factor here. Let me put it another way. If your time on Earth were to be broken down into a series of stats as if you were a baseball player, then the risks you take would be counted as one of the most important numbers you could ever post up. It wouldn't be the main number that defines your career, but it would say a lot about you. Risk wouldn't be your batting average if you were a great hitter, or your ERA if you were a great pitcher. The amount of risk you leveraged in your life would be your stolen bases or how many runners you picked off. It would be the mystery figure that slid under the radar, but upon further review told the story of exactly how you played the game. That number explains what you will do when faced with two outs in the bottom of the ninth. Whether you swing for the fences or bunt, no great success comes without great risk. If it were any other way, it wouldn't even be a game. It would be batting practice. If you know nothing about me, then start here. I love risk, and I chase it because that rush is what keeps me going. I have taken completely comfortable situations and turned them upside down for the risk of it. That's a selfish thing to do, but it had to happen because instability is what drives my creativity. This might seem like an excuse, but it's not. It's self-knowledge. I know that chaos is what fuels me. I am an engine that runs on it, and I keep that tank topped up better than I do the tank in my car. I've also found that life has a funny way of keeping things unstable for me. Every time I felt like I've had things figured out, life has thrown me a curveball. Because that's what life does. I've missed a lot of sinking curveballs, by the way. But those whiffs aside, when I talk about risk, I'm talking about the greatest rush I've ever known. And I've known a lot of them. It's a very powerful and specific high. It's not the rush you experience when you go all in and hit 21 at the blackjack table. Sure, that's great, but that's not it. It's not like the high you get if you win your first bet either. That's the intoxication of beginner's luck, which is actually a curse, because that will get you hooked for good if you're so inclined. I should know. I won my first bet, and I've never looked back. What I'm talking about runs even deeper than that, though. It comes from a place where losing might be just as fun as winning. So, in a way, you don't care about what happens as much as you care about the bet itself. Depending on how boring your life is, in some cases, losing can be even better than winning. I placed my first bet with a bookie when I was 15 years old. This might sound a bit early to some of you, but where I grew up in Newark, New Jersey, betting with bookies was a regular thing. My friend who was my age had an older brother who bet on sports every week, like all the older kids did. It was cool and exciting, and who didn't want to be as cool as the older kids growing up? Anyway, he got us in on the action, and once he did, I was done. The first bet I ever placed was in January 1985 on Super Bowl 19, the 49ers versus the Dolphins. All my buddies like Miami and Dan Marino. Following their lead seemed boring to me, so I did the illogical thing and bet on Joe Montana and the Niners. My friends thought I was crazy. They also thought I was an asshole because I was a Giants fan. And Giants fans never ever rooted for the Niners in the 80s. It was rivalry so deep that we didn't want them to even win a fucking coin toss. In the end, the Niners blew Miami out 38-16. And just like that, I won my first bet, and I was hooked on gambling. Winning your first bet is literally the worst thing that can happen to anyone. It's a brief victory that gives the winner a false sense of invincibility. I put $50 on that game, which means that I'd get $100 if I won. To bet $50, you had to pay $55 to cover the $5 vig, which is a service fee to the bookie. I won the bet and was handed $100, which made me feel like I'd won $100. That's the mirage. Winning completely erased the memory that my initial $50 was included in the prize money. It wasn't even $50. Whether I won or lost, the bookie kept the $5 vig, so all I could ever win was $45. I didn't see that at all. I just thought, this is great. I just won $100. That was the start of it all for me. And it won't ever end. But I've come to terms with that. Because you see, gambling on sports is fun. And I've done plenty of it, but I've moved on. When I was making real money in the 1990s, I really did some damage to my income, which is why I've made about $10 million over the years, but I'm worth around $2 million, if I'm being generous. How did I do it? Well, more than once I bet $25,000 on the coin toss at the Super Bowl. The odds are literally 50-50. It's pure chance, which is what I love about that bet. Anyway, that kind of betting stopped doing it for me, so I moved on to a much more serious type of wager. Gambling with intangible assets, like my life. This type of risk, and the thrill that comes with it, is dangerous, and something most people can't fathom when I try to explain it to them. If you don't get it, don't feel bad. You should feel happy, because if what I'm saying sounds strange, there's a good chance that you're normal, adjusted, sane, and functional. Don't change who you are, because if you're curious about this state of mind, worry no more. You can live vicariously through me. I'll do my best to explain it to you in this book, but if you still don't get it, just watch the headlines, because I'm living it every day. All you need to do is follow me on Twitter at Artie Quitter to see examples of my risk condition in real time. When I look back on my life, which is something you do when you're my age and realistically you shouldn't be alive, it's miraculous that my philosophy has worked for me. There are many reasons for that, the first of which is that show business loves second chances and thirds and fourths. Which is how I'm still able to buy into this craps game at all. The best way to explain what drives me is that, in simplest terms, I'm into a very different type of rush. I don't feel like I've done anything worthwhile until I've achieved something after risking everything, which comes from a place of not caring whether I win or lose, succeed or fail. I mean, sure, I like to succeed, but success without a risk or struggle? Doesn't seem honest to me. What I do when it comes to life is take risks, but also make risks when there aren't any. I know it sounds careless, but if it's done right, gambling like that isn't a dive into the abyss. It's sitting on the edge, telling the abyss to kiss your ass. Doesn't that sound exciting? If it does, I'd like to tell you about some beachfront property in Appalachia that I have for sale. If chaos is your best friend, or you feel most comfortable amid instability, you probably understand my frame of mind. That still doesn't mean you're the type to go to the extremes that I do. To me, risking and breaking even, or plodding along consistently, winning small, are fates worse than death. I would rather risk everything I have and lose than be bored. Luckily, I've managed to do that without making my mother or me homeless, though I have come close a few times. I pinpointed the moment I first caught this high. When I was 19, I was working construction, making about $12,000 a year. That's also when I developed a taste for booze and cocaine, which pair well with gambling if you want to cure a case of the boredoms, Anyway, one snowy Monday night, I was at a bar drinking and shooting the shit with a buddy of mine. We'd spent the weekend betting on every college and NFL game, and I don't remember if we were ahead or behind, but at that point, the only thing left to talk about was a Cleveland Browns game. Cleveland is a town with some degree of charm, but they've never had a strong football team. In fact, the Browns are probably the least winning, least cared about team in the history of the NFL or professional sports, for that matter. Back then, I knew nothing about their players, and I still don't. The Browns are not on anyone's radar, unless they're from Cleveland. My buddy was getting ready to go home that night, but I didn't want him to because I wasn't done with excitement. We were in a Jersey sports bar. It was cold, it was November, and it was Monday, so thrills were at a minimum. But I wouldn't accept that. "Hey, man," I said, "how much do you have in your bank account?" "I don't know, Art. Maybe $1,000, he said. "Great, you're not going anywhere. And here's what you're gonna do," I said. "Bet $1,500 on Cleveland. Kickoff is in half an hour. We still have time to call the bookie." "Are you kidding me?" he asked. "No." "Art, why would I do that? I don't know anything about this game. I don't even know who coaches Cleveland." "Exactly. What are you talking about? Why the hell should I bet on them then?" "Listen to me," I said. "You're bored, right? I mean, yeah, but come on, dude. Listen to me," I said. "You know nothing about this game, and neither do I. But no matter who wins, if you put $1,500 on the Browns to win, I can promise you one thing." "What's that?" "Without a doubt, the next 3 hours will be fucking exciting." My friend looked at me like he was seeing me for the first time, which in many ways he was. "Art, you're not kidding, are you?" "Not at all." "Man, you're fucking crazy." My buddy went home. I didn't. After he left, I called the bookie with 5 minutes to spare before kickoff. Remember this story as you listen to this audiobook, if you feel like you and I might be kindred spirits. We might have a few things in common, but at our core, I'd put good money on us being very different. And that's okay. That's actually good. You don't want to be like me. I'm sure some of you are listening to this and shaking your heads. Okay, fine. We're alike. You're crazy, too. I get it. You gamble. You risk it all. You live on the edge. That's cool, man. But let me ask you something. Have you ever been strung out on coke in Vegas at 5 a.m., asking your fellow degenerate gamblers if they knew the score of the East Coast Divisional Finals in girls' high school lacrosse? "Hey, man, did Connecticut win? Did they? Did they?" God, I hope you've never been there. In my nightmares, I still see the awkward stares. Because they'd lost. If you've read my other two books, you know how lucky I've been. I've also been foolish and destructive, and have needed all the help and second chances I've gotten. At this point, I spend my free time just trying to make sense of it all, and trying, believe it or not, to come to some sort of happy middle ground. Maybe not happy. I'll be happy enough with just middle. I recognize that risk and thrill are the driving forces in my life, so in order to better understand myself, I've tried to pinpoint a handful of the biggest risks that have defined my life, and I plan to tell you about them in this recording. I also plan to tell you about some of the people I grew up with, and the friends I've made, so you'll see other examples of risky people like me and how things turned out for them. Some risks, like skipping college to chase my dream, I'd never tell anyone not to do that. Others, like trying heroin, a drug I'd romanticized for years, I'd do anything to keep someone from following in my footsteps. Out of all my life's risks, that is the only one I wish I could take back. And if you'd like an in-depth understanding of why, read my second book, Crash and Burn. So, here's to a life lived in gambling, and here's to gambling with your life. I don't recommend it, but it's all I know how to do. There is no status quo for me. Just a lot of highs, a lot of lows, a lot of going all in, and getting by on sleight of hand, and the luck of the draw. Chapter 1. The Pot-Smoking Laugh. My father was a pivotal figure in my life. He was an opinionated wise-ass, he was hilarious, he was hard-working, and he possessed the kind of balls and inner-city know-how that cannot be taught. As much as he could, he turned life upside down and shook the spare change from its pockets. He was active and had a lot of energy, which made his last years on Earth very hard for him. After suffering a terrible accident on the job as an antenna repairman, he spent his last 4 years as a quadriplegic. My dad always took risks and lived according to nobody's rules, which is a trait I inherited for better and for worse. I regret nothing. And I hope I've done him proud, or at least given him a lot to laugh about up in heaven. At the end of his life, when my father was in his bed, desperate to escape the pain and the fate that life had dealt him, laughs were valuable. The story I'm about to tell you was one that would make him smile when nothing else could, no matter how many times he'd heard it. Birds of a feather flock together, so it shouldn't come as a surprise that a lot of my childhood friends were thick-headed risk-takers like me. Say what you will about us, but I am still in touch with all my closest friends from high school, except the ones who died. When we were kids, all of them believed they'd go for broke and take life by the balls like I did, only they didn't actually do it. They all had big plans. A lot of them wanted to be in bands, because when I was in junior high and high school, every guy I knew wanted to be in a band. I don't think that's changed, because being in a band is still the coolest thing you can do, if you're not funny enough to be a comedian. Anyway, a few thousand kids went to my high school, and it's safe for me to admit now that out of the white kids, I wasn't even close to being the funniest. If we are counting the black kids in my high school, I wouldn't even rank in the top 100. Remember this, because there is a reason why I'm here and they're not. All those guys helped me develop as a comedian, and I'm thankful. My high school was probably 33% Italian, 33% Irish, 33% black. There were some Hispanics, and exactly one Jewish kid, which I'm sure of because that kid was doomed. He was the odd man out, and to make matters worse, he wasn't Jewish enough. He lacked that instinctual, natural Jewish sense of humor that he desperately needed to fit in. He had none of it. He was, as Howard Stern would say, a goyishe cop, which is a Yiddish term used to refer to someone who is Jewish but isn't like a Jew. If you're a Jew, you would use this term to describe a Jewish colleague who isn't good with money, for example. Penguins and chickens, being birds who don't fly, are goyish cops. I've always loved that term, and Howard and I had this quid pro quo thing when it came to old world Jewish and Italian terms. Howard loved a few Italian slang phrases that he picked up from me, and they weren't even insults. They were just bad Italian-American bastardizations. One of his favorites was schwaiadel, which is a mutilated version of sfogliatelle, the word for an Italian pastry that non-Italians call a lobster tail. I said it during a drunken toast I gave in Las Vegas the first time we did the Howard Stern show out there, and he locked onto it. I got up and said something stupid like, "Salut, Chindon, Broccoli Rob, schwaiadel." None of those words, aside from salut, really have any business being in a toast, but he didn't care. I don't think he even knew. He just liked the sound of schwaiadel. That one stayed with him, and goyish cop stayed with me. The entire idea of a person who is bad at being what they were born to be is hilarious to me. It's inspiration, because that's what I am. That's what gambling is. That's what taking a risk means to me, being bad at what you are. If I were a Jew, I'd be a goyish cop, because any Jew who behaves the way I do with money is a very bad Jew. It's funny when Jewish and Italian-American cultures come together in unexpected ways, because at their roots, they're similar. both groups' mothers use guilt to control their children, and both groups' dominant religious institutions are controlling and hypocritical. They deal with misbehavior differently, but if you ask me, they're coming from the same place. And when they've mixed things up, some results have been innovative. The pizza bagel isn't a bad thing when you can't get a real slice. And if it weren't for Jewish and Italian-American culture coming together, we couldn't have the Ramones, who were one of the greatest rock and roll groups of all time. They were a bunch of Jewish guys posing as Italian greasers who went so far as to choose a ridiculous Italian-sounding name for themselves. Joey Ramone's real last name was Hyman, for Christ's sake. The Ramones acted Italian, but were very Jewish, except for Dee Dee. He was the Ramone who always got into trouble. I'm not sure he was Jewish, because he certainly did not act Jewish. I guess he was the Ramones' Goyish cop. He was immortalized with a statue right at the entrance to the Hollywood Forever Cemetery for all his misbehavior, God bless him. I was driving through my old neighborhood of Elizabeth, New Jersey, with my cousin the other day, and I got to thinking about all the Goyish cops I grew up with, none of whom will have a statue erected in their honor. I have to say, my family's old house and everything around it looks smaller. The whole place seemed different. The neighbors used to be lighter, and I'm not talking about their weight. There used to be strike zones painted on every bare brick wall you'd pass by, and it's just not like that anymore. We used to stay outside all night playing stickball against any number of walls until my friend Billy Hazelton's dad whistled. That was the signal and how we knew we had to go home. Everybody from Newark can do that whistle, by the way, either with their two pinkies or just their thumb and forefinger. It would be 9 at night, just starting to get dark, but we'd keep playing until we heard the whistle. That meant it was time for supper. Summer nights like that are my greatest memories of childhood. And I feel bad for these millennials that will never know what it was like being a real kid. In the summer, with no homework to do, we wouldn't see our parents for like 15 hours. We'd stay outside and make up games or other things to do. We socialized by talking to each other, which, believe it or not, is what spoken language was developed for. There was no texting, no cell phones, no one sending you a fucking emoji on your birthday. There isn't an emoji that can capture how we felt and what we experienced during those summer nights. How would I have said, "The Luciano brothers stole my wallet," in an emoji? The unlucky Luciano brothers, as we are going to call them here, taught me more about risk and not giving a fuck than anyone else I've ever known. They gave me my first taste of it, and they were my heroes. I've changed their names, by the way, even though they're both dead. That's how much I respect them. The older brother we will call Louis. He was 2 years older than I was. And the one who was my age we will call Tony. There was a place in North Newark called Two Guys Department Store, a name I will not change, which is where we used to steal things because that's what street kids do. At that place it was easy because the security guard was older than dirt. He was at the end of his career, capable of either that job or watching people steal burgers from White Castle. I got the feeling that he probably hadn't done anything too complicated earlier in life, which was great because nobody who steals wants to get caught. That type of old-school department store is a thing of the past, by the way. I'm not sure younger listeners understand what those places were like. It was divided into departments that were decorated differently, each with a bit of its own personality, and under one roof you could find everything from electronics and music to clothes, appliances, and furniture. It was a one-stop shopping center, except it wasn't bland like Target and Walmart. The outdoor department at Two Guys was hilarious to my friends and me because they had everything you needed to go camping in the Catskills, but we lived in such an urban area that tents were as useful to us as spacesuits. The most useless thing they had was a big orange canoe mounted on a wall, which sat there month after month. None of us had ever seen a lake or a river, and no one brought a boat like that to the public pool. One day, Louis, the older Luciano, coolly pointed to it and said, "I'm gonna steal a fucking canoe." "No, you're not," I said. "How are you gonna do that?" "What do you mean?" he asked. He glared at us long enough that we realized He wasn't kidding. Listen to me. It's a perfect crime. Why? Because nobody steals a fucking canoe. We just nodded. Louis, if they see you taking it, they'll know you're stealing it, his brother said. No. Listen to me, Louis said. I'm gonna walk out like I just bought it. And no one is gonna stop me, okay? Why would they? Are they gonna think I stole the canoe? No way! They won't think that. Because no one steals a fucking canoe. Off he went, casually, like he owned the joint. My father was like that, too, because, like a lot of city people, he knew that if you act like you own the place, you can get away with anything. Unfortunately, computers and surveillance cameras have changed the odds on that quite a bit. These days, the barcode that is your face is easy to track down. So if you walk out of a store with a canoe and don't set off an alarm, give them time. They will find you anyway. And when they do, if you've ever been caught with a joint or haven't paid a parking ticket, you'll probably end up doing 3 to 5 in Leavenworth. Anyway, Louis strolled over and confidently removed the canoe from the wall without attracting any attention. Then he balanced it on his head and started walking calmly toward the door. We followed 10 feet behind him, trying to be cool. I need to tell you something about Louis. He was the first time I encountered the pot-smoking laugh. I've encountered it many times since, but Louis was my first. The pot-smoking laugh is like a stutter. Real low. Almost a hiccup. It's just... It's uncontrollable. Like marijuana-induced Tourette's. It's always in a weird tone that is drastically unlike the person's typical speaking voice. It's very common among heavy, lifelong pot smokers, but it was a part of Louis' DNA by age 14. He was the Jeff Spicoli of Elizabeth, New Jersey. The pot-smoking laugh is funny, but it's no joke, because if you cross that line, you'll never be the same. Just look at Sean Penn. He launched his acting career on that laugh, and he's never been able to shake it. These days, he gives speeches on world peace to the UN General Assembly, and it sneaks up on him. I can imagine him there saying, "We can't let Castro pay these." He can't help lapsing into Spicoli. The thing is, everyone ignores it because everything else he says is brilliant. It's a slippery slope, and it's hard to climb back up, so keep this in mind the next time you laugh while you're stoned. What also happens with the pot-smoking laugh is that your head bobs up and down in time, making it even more obvious that you're a huge pot smoker. This takes the average person years, but Louis was there at 14. When he put the canoe on his head, he understandably started laughing, and because of his pot-smoking laugh, the canoe started bobbing up and down. The canoe also echoed and amplified his laugh, which freaked him out and made him laugh harder. He sounded like a madman in an asylum, giggling at the end of a hallway. But he didn't stop marching toward the door, wearing the dumbest orange hat in the world. Louis was right, by the way. It didn't matter how hard he laughed and bobbed on his way out. No one stopped him. The year was 1979, so there were no fancy alarm systems. Just an old white guy who looked like Matlock if he had failed the bar exam. The guard actually paused as Louis approached, then nodded at him and told him to have a good weekend. "Enjoy your weekend, son," the old guy said. "All right, thanks, I will," Louis said. It was a very strange moment. It felt like the guard knew all about Louis's big plans to canoe down the nearest rushing river. Louis was the coolest person I knew before stealing the canoe. Afterward, he was a living legend. He was gambling before I knew what risking something even meant. Louis walked through the parking lot laughing so hard that he banged the canoe into every single car he passed as people cursed and jumped left and right to avoid him. And it was the greatest thing I'd ever seen. Exactly 24 hours later, my buddy Mike called me. This is how I remember the conversation. "Are you sitting down?" Mike asked. "Why, what happened?" I said. "Listen to me. You have to sit down. You're gonna laugh so hard." "Come on, man, what happened? You didn't hear about Luciano, did you?" No. He got arrested. Why? He got busted for the canoe? Yes. No. You sitting down? Louis Luciano made off with the canoe, but the very next day got clipped at two guys for attempting to steal the oars. Somehow, that guard became Columbo overnight and bagged him. Hey, the old guy said as Louis tried to slip out with the oars under his arm like two baguettes. Hey, you there, stop! Are you the guy who took the canoe? Apparently at that point, a younger guard tackled Louis, because Sherlock was in no shape for that. Louis Luciano did time in juvie for his actions, by the way. And that was a terrible gamble on his part. He went to Boys Town because the canoe heist qualified as grand larceny. Grand larceny was being caught stealing goods with a value over $500, and the canoe's sticker price was $515. How about that crap luck? Stealing that boat was a grown-up crime in the eyes of the police by just $15. If you saw a photo of me hanging out with those guys, I wouldn't blame you if you predicted I'd be dead by 25. I would have bet the under myself. When Louis went off to juvie, that moment in time was gone for good, which is probably why some of us are still alive. After that summer, I lost track of the Lucianos, and vice versa. Their parents were ne'er-do-well nomads who were never around, to the degree that Tony lived with my girlfriend's family in high school for a while, when things got really bad. My ex-girlfriend's father, who was a barber, was friends with the Luciano's father. They referred to themselves as Camparis, which is Italian-American slang for two friends whose families are intertwined all the way back to the old country. If you've got one, you can count on a Campari. Anyway, Louis was the king of the world in our neighborhood for 24 hours. He risked it all and won. Then he got greedy and lost everything, all in the same day, which is how gambling works. It's a roller coaster ride. And we all find different reasons to buy that ticket and buckle up. Louis went back to the store because he needed the accessories to sell the canoe. There was a guy in Newark who sold stolen goods out of a shop on North 7th Street right by Branchbrook Park. He took it all. Jewelry, radios, musical instruments, clothes, anything. Except canoes. What the fuck am I gonna do with a canoe? This is fucking North Newark, kid. I can't sell a canoe. Then he reconsidered. Know what? I can sell it to my jerk-off cousin. He's outdoorsy. But I need the oars. Get me some oars, and you got a deal, kid. The next day, Louis Luciano went back for the oars and ended up in Nebraska, in Boys Town for 6 months. He came back even tougher, with a tattoo cut into his arm with a razor blade. It was a very creative prison tattoo. It said his name. The thing that the Lucianos were best known for, by the way, was stealing car stereos. They made a killing doing it in the years following the canoe heist, up until the day they got caught. Tony, the younger brother, was better known as Sticky Elbows, because every time he broke a window, the glass stuck to his arm. Every time. The Lucianos were profiled by the cops and hauled into court before they were 18 and were sentenced identically. They were given probation, and on their way out of court, they stole a pair of car stereos from the parking lot. They both made sure the cars that they stole from had government plates, hoping that one of them belonged to the judge who had just sentenced them. Another kid I went to school with rode a bike out of the same department store. Same approach, same guard, same store. Like Louis, he figured that no one would question someone crazy enough to ride out on stolen wheels. There is a way to go so crazy with your plan that no one questions what you're doing. You confuse them so much that you're gone before they realize what just happened. Expert gamblers and thieves of any age know how people think. They can predict the average person's reaction. And if there is one thing that the security guard at Two Guys Department Store was, it was average. That poor bastard was such a boob, probably a retired postman, who didn't expect the neighborhood youth to be so bold. But I have to give him credit. He momentarily got it together in those crucial 24 hours after the heist. He went home and came back at the top of his game and was thereby able to apprehend Louis when he returned for the oars. "Hey, you there," the guard said, eyeing the dead giveaway, the oars. "Stop! Are you the guy who took the canoe?" Chapter 2 Long Shot. At 23, I had a job as a longshoreman working in Port Newark, and it was the first bit of stability that I experienced as a young man. Before I got the job, I spent a year working with my buddy in his family's machine shop, cleaning up. I'd oil the machines and sweep up the metal shavings, which invariably ended up as a thin layer of gray dust coating the top of the pizza we ate at the end of every shift. That job left me feeling even more hopeless and unsure of what I could possibly do with myself for the rest of my life. I had everything ahead of me and nothing in front of me, with no idea whatsoever as to what was going to happen. Until a different buddy's father, who was a major figure in the International Longshoremen's Association, took pity on our family situation and handed me a job at the port. My father's accident had ravaged our family. The medical bills, necessary home renovations, and equipment we needed to care for him at home left us in debt up to our ears. We were forced to go on welfare and live on food stamps, and for years we tried to get reimbursements for Medicaid, but got next to nothing in the end. We needed a helping hand. When I started the job, we were completely bankrupt. My mother is a very proud woman, so this upset her tremendously, but she'd had no choice. She'd had to take a second mortgage out on the house to pay for everything, and we were underwater trying to keep up with the payments. But between my new job and my mom's, we were able to keep the house and begin to get life back to normal. I worked as a longshoreman for a year and a half, making $70,000 plus bonuses, which is a very good living when you're 23 years old and haven't graduated high school. But that wasn't enough for me. So in the fall of 1991, I gave my mother about $4,000 in spending money, plus another $5,000 that I'd put into a savings account, the first savings account I ever opened, and I told her that I wanted to quit my job and pursue a career in stand-up comedy. A few years earlier, when I was 19, I'd tried stand-up twice, and both times I'd bombed. I've bombed a lot since, and have seen countless people bomb, but I still count my first two stand-up attempts as some of the worst minutes of comedy I've ever seen. Even though I lacked the balls to dust myself off and stick with it, I thought about it all the time. My jokes, which I continued to write, were passable, but that didn't matter, because I had a bigger issue. I wasn't comfortable on stage. Both times, I'd frozen up like a deer in headlights and choked. Being on stage at a comedy club is disorienting because at most places, especially the rat holes where you can get time as a newcomer, the lights are in your face, so you know the audience is there, but you can't see most of them. You're up there alone, under a microscope, feeling the eagerness of an invisible group of people waiting to be entertained. It still fucks with my head sometimes. I decided to take some acting classes, hoping to get comfortable performing in front of a crowd. That plan might have worked if I'd had the money to really commit to it, but I didn't, so I took one class in New York, and that was that. Instead of finding anything constructive to do with my free time, I spent my nights and weekends fucking around, hitting on chicks, drinking too much, and doing as much coke as I could afford. In my early 20s, cocaine replaced weed as my drug of choice, and I can trace that back to my job in the machine shop, because after sweeping up toxic dust all day and eating it like extra Parmesan on top of my dinner, all I wanted to do was get as high and drunk as possible before going back to do it all over again in the morning. I was living life day to day at best. When I got to the port, I made more money, and the regimen helped stabilize things for me and for my family, but things were still pretty unstable. I was never going to be satisfied with my unfulfilled dream still eating at me, so the moment things leveled out, I asked my mother's permission to throw caution to the wind. "Ma, this is going to sound corny, but there's no other way to put it," I said. I have a dream in me. I can keep doing what I'm doing, and we can both have a nice life, but I have a dream in me, and it's a big risk. When I was in my 20s, being 50 held a lot of meaning to me. By 50, I figured that I'd be old enough to wake up and hate myself for never trying comedy again, and still young enough to have to live with my failure until the day I died. In my 20s, I thought that if I hadn't done it by 50, I would rather be dead. I'm 50 now, and have exceeded my dreams. I didn't expect to be as successful at comedy as I am. I never could have predicted getting on Stern or in any of the films or network TV shows that I've done. I would have been satisfied with a career on the road playing clubs, so long as I made a living. I knew in my 20s that by 50, the resentment I'd feel for everybody doing what I'd wanted to do would be tremendous. If I never tried, I knew I'd hate them almost as much as I hate Aziz Ansari. Resentment is a devil that will eat you up inside, which is why I tell the girls who date me that I absolutely have to cheat on them if I get the chance. Usually they don't follow my logic, but I'm not lying. If I have the chance to cheat and don't, I'll resent them forever. Take Dana, my ex-girlfriend, whom Stern listeners got to know very well during the 5 years that we dated. Things were casual between us until after the first time we took the show to Vegas for a week of live shows. When I returned, I asked Dana to be my girlfriend, which we talked about on the air, but the truth is that we were very much together before I left. When I got back, though, I had a confession to make. I told her that I'd slept with a girl in Vegas, just once. The girl in question was a stripper whore who I said came on to me, then charged me $500. That detail, as well as my confession, made it onto the air. I've never admitted this before because I didn't want to hurt Dana's feelings, but that wasn't true. And it also wasn't the end of the story. We did the show live at the Hard Rock Hotel, outside by the pool, for 5 glorious days. In those 5 days, I didn't sleep with just one girl. I slept with 11. Yes, that's right, 11. 11 strippers, to be exact. And that tally includes 2 threesomes. Now that I'm being honest, they may have been stripper whores, but I can't be certain because I didn't pay for any of them. Most of them were employed by a major impresario who owns strip clubs with a name that sounds like Schmearmint Wino. I don't know if they were paid. I only know that they were seasoned pros. At the time, Fred Norris was happily married with a beautiful new daughter, Howard was loyal to Beth, and Robin Quivers, being a sophisticated broadcaster and cultured person, had no interest in sordid pursuits. That left little old me to enjoy the spoils for the whole team. I felt like Elvis for 5 days and nights, and I loved every minute of it. In every casino, at every club, guys would chant my name. I had off-the-charts Vegas 12s hitting on me, all of them asking me to make them famous by mentioning their names and websites on the air. It was incredible. I was momentarily John Stamos, except funny. For once in my life, I didn't need to tell a girl that I'd written Jurassic Park or that I was Newman from Seinfeld to get laid. No lie was better than the truth, that I was on the biggest radio show of all time and that if I mentioned any strippers or porn stars' website on the air, the Stern audience would flock to them. All of them knew that Stern fans were exactly the kind of perverts who would pay for their live cams and buy their used panties and set them up for life. They also knew that I encouraged pay-for-play promotions, and I wasn't after cash. Do you have a website where you get guys off over the internet? Do you want to make $1 million doing that? Let Uncle Artie help you out. Honey, I say your name on the airwaves and whoosh, your dream will come true. You see, Uncle Artie isn't on any old radio show, my little chickadee. He's not on your local yokel Bob and Ted morning drive, and he's not on the fucking Innie and Goofball morning madhouse. He ain't on Cousin Brucey or the Dick Lick and Fruit Loop Power Hour. Uncle Artie is on the greatest radio show that ever was. He's on the one, the only Howard Stern show. That year, in 2003, Arbitron, the wing of the Nielsen Company that tracks radio ratings, did a study. By then, I had been on Stern for a couple of years, and I'm not saying it had anything to do with me because I hopped on what was already a runaway gravy train. I will say that by 03, we were in a groove, and in my opinion, embarking on our best period together. The numbers reflected that because according to Arbitron, in 2003, at 9:15 a.m. on the days when we did a live show, an average of 14 million people were listening to us. 14 million people. I still can't believe that number. The population of the United States in 2003 was approximately 290 million, which means that at 9:15 a.m. on days when we were live, roughly 20% of American adults were listening. Considering what we were typically talking about, most of you should be ashamed of yourselves. I love to use that clout to my advantage, and not just to get laid. Say I was playing Zanies in Chicago any given weekend. If I mentioned the gig on the air a few times, by Thursday, it would be sold out. Living hell for a touring comedian is doing radio appearances in an unfamiliar town because his show isn't sold out. I never had to, which meant precious extra hours of sleep for me until the promoter picked me up at my hotel room 30 minutes before I had to go on. Hey, buddy, come get me when it's time for me to put your kids through Harvard. Let's be honest. The promoter's kids were probably going to DeVry. But he could have afforded Harvard with all the tickets I sold. That's what the strength of 14 million people can do. Anyway, let's get back to the fact that I fucked 11 strippers in 5 days, which included 2 threesomes. I was the only guy in those threesomes, by the way, in case anyone was keeping the box score of this game. Box score? Get it? I was in heaven. I was 32 years old. I had more testosterone coursing through my veins than Jose Canseco on juice, and for the first time in my life, for that week at least, I experienced what it's like to be good-looking and desired by chicks. As I've already mentioned, when I got home, I told Dana that I'd slept with one stripper, and I took a gamble with how I chose to explain it. "I had to, babe," I said. "I would have resented you if I didn't go through with it. I didn't seek it out or try to make it happen. It just fell into my lap. Every guy dreams of being a famous athlete, a musician, and having women throw themselves at their feet. My career has finally taken off to the point that in my world, I'm kind of a rock star. So in certain situations, I can get laid because of that. I've wanted to experience that kind of treatment my entire life, but now I have you, and you're much more important." Sleeping with that one stripper was my way of making up for lost time. It was symbolic. I did it just the once, and I promise you, that's it. Dana was easy to read, and I could tell that as mad as she was, she saw a small amount of truth in what I was saying, so I kept at it. "Dana, I know this sounds crazy, but you have to understand that if I didn't do what I did, it would have become a big problem for us. When I look back on my life and our relationship, I'd see you as the person who came between me and my one chance at fulfilling a rock star fantasy I've had since I was 14 years old. And you know what would have happened? I'm not saying this is right, but I would have ended up resenting you for it." "Really?" she asked. By this point, she looked more sad and concerned than angry. "Really?" I said. "I'd probably resent you for the rest of my life. And honey, I don't want to do that." Somehow she bought it. And in return, I bought her an Hermes handbag so everyone went home happy. She got presents, and I got a steady date to industry parties. I'm just kidding. The truth is, Dana and I were very much in love for 5 years. She was my best friend and a great girlfriend, and of all the relationships I've had, I think Dana and I had what it took to have a great marriage and a life together, if we'd been able to stick it out. We didn't stand a chance, because nothing can survive the combination of heroin and a life spent on the road. It still makes me sad to think about it. We were doomed by the only life I know how to live. and the only gamble I regret taking. For 3 years in a row, we did the Stern Show for 1 week in Vegas, each time at the Hard Rock Hotel, and each time Howard finagled a private jet through Viacom to fly us out. It was a 14-seat G6 Gulfstream, with just 6 guys on board plus one smoking hot stewardess. We'd drink, eat sushi, play poker. We'd fat shame and body judge and call women chicks. We talked about grabbing pussy and buying furniture. And if Billy Bush had come on board, he would have ended up skydiving home without a parachute. In Vegas, the airport that services private jets is a stone's throw from the Hard Rock. So coming into land, we'd get a bird's-eye view of the enormous pool, the stage, and the area they roped off for our show. There would be about 4,000 strippers waiting there for us, hoping to get noticed and invited on the air. The first time I saw all those women in bikinis, I began shaking with anticipation. Honest to God, I had tremors, and I said to myself, "This is it. This is almost what it must feel like to be a Rolling Stone." I never would have experienced any of that, of course, if my mother hadn't allowed me to take that second swing at comedy. It was a gamble on both of our parts, and I'd say it paid off. I'll never forget the conversation. We were in our kitchen, and I told her what I wanted to do and that I'd put some money aside for her to live on. I said I'd get a job driving a cab to support myself so she wouldn't have to worry. She was quiet for a while, and I really had no idea what she was going to say. I'll work 2 jobs if I have to," she finally said. "Just do it. Quit the port and try. But you have to really try. This is your last chance." "Thank you, Ma. I promise you I will. Give me 4 years. Consider it my college. Give me from 22 to 26. If it doesn't work, if I can't make a living doing comedy in some way, I'll go back to the port and that will be the end of it." Exactly 3.5 years later, I was a cast member on Mad TV, and I've never looked back. I made about $300,000 that year, which was more money than anyone in our family had ever seen. I've managed to remain above that ever since, sometimes way above it, and sometimes just squeaking by. I'm where I am because my mother took a chance. I also had a lot of luck, and I mean a lot of luck. There's an old Italian phrase. It's either a Sicilian or a Neapolitan dialect that an uncle of mine, who is no longer with us, used to say about me. He used to say it in Italian and explained that it translated to something like, "Idiot's luck. If you had it, you weren't aware of it. But it kept good things happening to you even though you were a fuck-up." To him, that's what I was. A shithead who'd keep stepping in pots of gold my whole life, somehow blessed in a way that I didn't deserve. At holiday dinners and barbecues, when he'd hear stories about stupid things I'd done, he'd just shake his head and say, "Yeah, he's got it, that thing." And he'd point to the top of his head where I presume people like me have an invisible, lucky halo hovering over them. Either that or he was indicating retardation. Whatever it was, my uncle was right. There had been so many instances of that thing saving my ass, but looking back on life now, at 50, I'm convinced that there's even more to it. I have to give myself some credit because there's having that thing, but there's also knowing how to play it to your advantage. I've never felt that I could waltz through life, leaving my fate up to St. Cajetan, the Catholic saint of good fortune and the patron saint of gamblers, but I have felt lucky in life. And this is where taking risks gets interesting, because if you ask me, luck is what you make of it. It's not a divine force beyond our control. It's an opportunity. It's like the benevolent older brother of risk looking out for you. But you may be stubborn, and you may ignore that older brother's advice. And if you do that, you're a loser who risked in vain and missed the boat. Let me give you an example. Meeting my co-writer, Anthony, was all timing and luck. I would not have 2 best-selling books without him. I could have told the same stories the same way to another writer, but the resulting books wouldn't have been anything close to what they are. The fact that he was available at the time that I was ready to write a book was sheer chance, because he'd had a lot of success and had other offers on the table. He was also the first guy I met. I remember my agent saying, "This kid Anthony wrote Slash's book, Eminem's book, and Tommy Lee's. See if you like him." I love Slash. I always have, so I bought the book in the airport on the way to a gig, and I fucking devoured it during a week on the road. I literally could not put it down. I called my agent and said, "I want to meet this guy. I love that book." The agent said, "Yeah, he's really good, and that's a great one. It's got to number 6 on the New York Times bestseller list. Don't get your hopes up, because you're not going to do that well, but I bet you'll make the lower end of the list. Probably the top 20 at best, because of Howard. I'll see if Anthony's interested." For many reasons, I later fired that agent. But after the book came out, it was so great to tell him, "Yeah, we made the top 20, asshole. We made it all the way to number 1. I'm an avid reader, and always have been, which might come as a surprise to my fans and haters alike. I'm always reading nonfiction, usually biographies and books about film, baseball, and American history. Writing a book had always been a dream of mine. I just never thought I'd find the guy for me. I'd met comedy writers, magazine writers, all kinds of writers who wanted to collaborate with me, but I hadn't met one that I wanted to spend more than an hour with, let alone spill my life story to. I didn't expect book writers to be any different. And the others I met weren't. But lo and behold, the first one I met was exactly my guy. I knew it right away, so I didn't deliberate. If I had, Anthony might have chosen another project, and the words you're reading now might never have made it onto the page. In life, taking advantage of moments like that are just as important as taking the risks that define you. It's not only how much you bet, but for lack of a better cliche, it's also knowing when to hold 'em and when to fold 'em. Sure, I might have that thing, but for all my losses, I've heard luck when it's whispered in my ear. If you listen to your instincts and risk appropriately when the time is right, you'll end up exactly where you want to go. Learn to trust what your gut has to say, because it's the only thing that never lies to you. Chapter 3. Sliding Doors, Part 1. Does anyone remember that Gwyneth Paltrow movie, Sliding Doors? It came out in the late 90s, and it's about how different the main character's life would have been if she'd caught or missed a train on the way home from work. It's about parallel universes and possibilities and how one small detail can change everything. I've realized that the film speaks to the realities of my life quite a bit. Not only because it's a dramatic rom-com, but because a lot of people tell me that I remind them of Gwyneth Paltrow. Timing has meant everything in my life and my career. Meeting Anthony and writing the books, meeting Norm Macdonald and being cast in Dirty Work, meeting Quincy Jones and landing a role on Mad TV, all these opportunities came to me as if they were waiting there just for me, and I pounced on them. But none of it would have meant a thing if my mother hadn't said, "Go for it." Quitting the port with her permission was the train I caught. Now let's take a look at what my life would have been like if the subway doors had shut and I'd missed that Uptown Express. We have to rewind to 1991 and return to the Lang family kitchen, where my mother, Judy Lang, is having a different reaction to her only son's request to take another swing at his dream. "Ma, I have a dream in me. I want to do stand-up comedy. I've made good money at the port the past year and a half. I've saved up a few grand here to give you to tide you over, and, well, I'd like to give it a shot." In this version, my mother doesn't think it over very long. "Sorry, Art, you can't do that," she says. "We've been through hell, and we are finally getting on our feet. You're making good money, and you need to keep it up. Forget about comedy. You tried it a few years ago, and you were horrible." I try to stay cool, but it isn't easy. "You're funny, Art. You really are," she continues. "You make me laugh every day, but you're no comedian. Do you really think you're good enough to be on David Letterman? Who do you think you are, some kind of Italian Seinfeld? Think about what happened last time. You have to keep your job. You've got a good thing going, and there's no way I can support us while you try to make it in comedy. I'm sorry. Okay, Ma. You're right. I love you. I'm going up to bed. My mother, being a full-blooded